Readings from the Rex Deus Society, written by E.B. McGee and read by Yvonne Blackstone. I married at 12 into a forbidden Knights Templar family and became privy to secret knowledge of enormous scale and consequence. My name is Jeanne de Charnay, one of the forgotten women of the 14th century. Unless we were queens, history simply ignored us. My father was a minor member of the French nobility, one of the three classes of people, nobility, clergy, and peasants. A fourth class, the merchants, was beginning to rise at this time, upsetting the status quo, confusing nobles and peasants alike, and adding another layer to the complexities of our life. That year, 1351, I was chosen by the King of France to be married to the great Lord de Charnay, who was then 45, placing me in the epicenter of French politics. The most famous knight of his time, he was called the Uncrowned King of France, not only by the French, but even by our hated enemy, the English. By marriage, I was caught up in an elite, extremely secret sect of the Knights Templar. Chapter 1. An Old Chest. There in the gloom of one of the cellars, I found an old chest covered with dust. I came upon it in innocence, for I had gone down there with cause, a bride taking stock of her new domain. Inside was nothing save a piece of old linen, but the cloth was still in good condition, perfectly usable. Seeing that it could be made into aprons for the scullery maids, who were in need, there having been no mistress in this castle these long years, I carried it up to the great hall and spread it out. Leaving it there, I went in search of someone to cut it. I had not yet mastered the names of my new ladies, who were in no hurry to take me as their mistress, and not a one of them was anywhere to be found. Finally, from the loggia, I saw them, like giant flowers in the meadow. Lady Blanche, who clearly had no favor toward me, she was one of the many here who had been in service to Lady de Touche, Geoffrey's first wife, had taken them all out there across the drawbridge to walk on this lovely, warm, late October day. Blanche, my darling Geoffrey had explained to me, had been head nurse at Lady de Touche's birth, and then later, her chief lady-in-waiting. Indeed, since the death of Lady de Touche, 8 years now, with Lord de Charnay off and away, Blanche had clearly come to believe that she was the lady of Pierre Persuay Castle. She called me not Lady de Charnay, as was my rightful due, but Lady Montfort, a mere visitor here. Blanche always spoke of Geoffrey's first wife as mistress, as if Lady de Touche would appear at any moment, the keys to the castle stores dangling at her waist. I was determined to find the courage to speak to Blanche in private about this and request that she call me Lady de Charnay, or at least Lady Jeanne. Finding no one to help me with the cloth, I returned to the great hall. There stood my husband, holding up a fold of the cloth with two fingers of his right hand. Not hearing me come into the room, Geoffrey began folding the cloth most carefully, as if it were the shroud of our dear Lord himself. Yes, it was cut as a shroud, I knew that, but good linen is good linen, and we were not so well off here at Pierre Persuay, nor in all of France since the pestilence, and the endless battles with England on French soil, that we could afford to ignore thrift. I stood still, watching as my husband finished gathering up the cloth. Without a word, he headed down the stairs. Knowing where he was going, I took a candle in each hand and followed him. When he reached the cellar doors, Geoffrey finally realized I was behind him. Bending to kiss my forehead, he then pushed the creaking doors open. "No one," he said, "has business down here." Then, seeing the chest gaping open, the lock dangling loose, his voice turned strange, almost strangled. "What is this? The lock has been broken off? Who has done this deed? Tell me, my dear, who carried this cloth up to you?" "No one, sire. I carried it up in my own hands." "You?" Geoffrey was standing there in the dim light, holding the linen cloth in his hands, shaking his head. with a look that I had not seen before, as the candle's flames cast an eerie light over his face. "Jean, how could you have done such a thing?" "What, sir?" I challenged him, trying to make him smile. "Am I not allowed to open old chests here in my new home?" I knew that I could speak to him in so bold a manner, because Geoffrey loved me in the way that the new wed have. With me, Geoffrey was so unlike the fearsome knight in armor, as the English knew him. Unlike the stern mentor to kings, as King John and the great French lords knew him. And unlike the brilliant writer of books about chivalry and battle, as the knights knew him. We ourselves, not the pages, were the ones who stood at the drawbridge mid-mornings, giving out beer and leftover bread to the beggars. Then we would race our horses into the meadow like wanton children and fall into the high grass in each other's arms. Afterward, I would weave a caplet of flowers. Geoffrey hated to take off his beret, but I would pull it off and put the garland around his shining head. How handsome he looked, crowned with flowers. How young. We would take a basket of cheese and bread, grapes and wine, and in his raspy voice, Geoffrey would sing me the newest songs of the troubadours. Not about battles, not about King John and his fearsome cousin, the Black Prince of England. Not even about King John's son-in-law, Charles of Navarre, that thorn in France's side. But about love. Who would believe that this valiant knight was such a lover at heart? Such was my new husband, so I knew that this shroud that I had found must be of great importance when he spoke to me in such grave words, saying, "You broke the lock." In spite of my racing heart at the sternness of his voice, I raised my chin, for I knew that this was what Geoffrey loved in me, my high spirit. "I have done no such thing, good sir," I said, tossing my head. "Look, the lock has quite rusted away. I had only to touch it, and it fell off all on its own." Bending down, examining the lock, he saw that I was right. But Geoffrey did not apologize for his misspeaking, which brought a rush of blood to my cheeks. All he said was, "I must have a new chest made." "A new chest? Is this cloth so important?" Not answering me, he placed the cloth back in the dark recesses of the chest as gently as if it were a newborn child. Closing the heavy lid, he sat down firmly upon the top, almost as if to keep me from trying to open it again. "This must be kept here, safely hidden, and it is not something to be talked about, Jean." I was of such an inquisitive nature, it was one of my confessed faults, that I had to know what was so worrisome about this piece of cloth. "I surely shall not speak of it, but will you tell me why it must be kept here in secret?" With the candles burning ever lower, Geoffrey put his finger to my lips, warning me. If such words are heard, it could mean trouble. Trouble? For whom? Geoffrey leaned forward, rubbing his hands over his bald head. I had already learned that he did this when he was trying to clear his mind. Finally, he said, "Not in all these long years have I ever spoken of this, Jean." A reading from Chapter 7. The months passed, and we celebrated the last days of summer with a great picnic in the meadow. Pages, under the watchful eyes of the seneschal and his son, carried baskets laden with food, decanters of wine, crockery, musical instruments, and rolled-up reed mats to put on the ground, everything for a grand feast among the wildflowers. Blanche, Lady Diana, Lady Catherine, and some of the others have chosen not to come, for they did not care to sit on mats in the ground, fanning away the lazy bees of late summer. As we were crossing the drawbridge on foot, and my younger ladies were gushing over baby Charlotte in her nanny's arms, Geoffrey came up on horseback, hoisted our son up onto the saddle of his hunter, and galloped on past us into the meadow. How happily little Geoffrey squealed, his blonde curls flying in the wind, and how the nannies tutted their disapproval. Watching them together, father and son, I was proud that my son had crusader blood. It already showed, as young as he was, little Geoffrey was quite fearless. As the baskets were laid out on the mats in the tall grass, I noticed that my young ladies were acting strangely. "What is the matter with them?" I asked Anna. "They're flirting." "Flirting? With whom?" "With my lord." I was not jealous. Indeed, I was honored. "With Lord Geoffrey? Heavens no," Anna said. "Look." All I could see was the Chenasal sun. "Not him," I said. "My ladies know better than to pay a peasant any heed." "Oh, do they?" Anna tossed her head. "How are you so sure of that?" As I watched, I saw that, indeed, Anna was right. At his every movement, they blushed, giggling behind their hands. "Surely," Anna said, "you have seen, when he enters a room with those messages from his father, that half of your ladies are batting their eyes at him, and the other half are near to swooning." "For that boy? Boy! Jean, he is older than we are. Well, older than I am." "That would make him nearing 14. Anna was right. He was no longer the scrawny lad that he had been when I first arrived at Pierre Perchouet. "You haven't noticed?" "Well, of course you wouldn't," Anna said. "But you are probably the only female in this castle, gentlewoman to scullery maid, who hasn't." I gave Anna a sharp look, which she understood. "I exempt myself, of course, but I do think," she added mischievously, "that the Seneschal's son makes even old Blanche wish that she was young again. He is quite beautiful, isn't he?" "That is neither here nor there," I said. "There may be high-born ladies lifting their skirts behind the drapery in this castle, which I certainly hope they are not. But I will not have it said that in Geoffrey de Charnay's castle I allow my ladies to be seduced by a knave, however handsome he may be." "Or seduce him," Anna said, giving me a sly smile. "If I catch any of the ladies in this castle having a dalliance with that young man, I will have her flogged like a commoner, upon my word." "Tell that to Blanche," Anna said, "and it will be all over the castle in less time than it takes you to say it." "Anna, I will be as good as my word." "I do not doubt it, my lady," Anna said in mock seriousness. We had a wonderful picnic, with music and dancing in the meadow, but I was not happy. Watching the Seneschal's son, Anna was right. He could perhaps be quite a temptation. I would have to keep an eye on my younger ladies. A reading from chapter 21. The first things that I saw, my heart went cold, when we went down to the banquet, were hundreds of flags hanging from the rafters of the great hall, all bearing the cross of the Templars. Banners draping the high table bore Templar crosses. Shields lining the walls, every one of them, had the Templar cross, red on a field of white. If not a full cross, then one on at least two of the quadrants. I was in a Templar stronghold. Lord Amon took my arm as I entered the hall and led me to the table of honor. Anna and Charlotte were taken to one of the tables directly below us. At the far back of the hall, I saw the knights who had escorted us from Pierre Perchouet laughing, stuffing their mouths, drinking their fill, savoring the bounty of Lord Amon's table. In the morning, they would leave, heading home, and Anna, Charlotte, and I would be truly alone here. "This is my brother, Amadeus, Court of Geneva," Lord Amon said. "Lady de Charnay, Count Amadeus." "The honor is mine," the Count said, bowing low, kissing my hand. "Welcome to the House of Geneva." Lord Amon introduced me to his nephews. The oldest was Amon, looking remarkably like his uncle, my new lord. The second was Amadeus, named after his father, the Count. The third was Peter, and I was glad to hear a different name. Finally, the youngest, tallest, and handsomest, Robert, was introduced. He was 22, 3 years younger than I. Of the brothers, Robert was the one with the composed elegance of his father, as if he should be next in line to be the count, not fourth, behind three older brothers. Even though none of the four had married, it was Robert who would be the perfect match for Anna. During the banquet, I learned otherwise. Robert was a bishop of the church, although he was in elegant evening clothing. At the high table that night, Robert was the most demanding, the most unforgiving with the carvers, the pickiest with the servers. Did they detest him? No, they worshipped him. Robert had a charisma that was undeniable. Even at that first supper, it was obvious to me that he loved to dominate the conversation, not as my Lord Geoffrey had done, for the purpose of imparting information, but to amaze us. Everyone in the castle, including the Count, doted upon this youngest son. Thank you for listening to Selections from the Rex Dais Society, read by Yvonne Blackstone.